Have you ever felt just too weird or just too awkward or too big or too small or too uncoordinated or just too something? I know I have. When I was in the fourth grade, the boys in my class used to play a game that they thought was really fun, which was called Let's See How Fast We Can Get Elizabeth to Blush. And it was not a very hard game, because as soon as I saw everyone looking at me and felt their eyes on me, I would turn this bright, deep red. And then I would be embarrassed and ashamed that I had gotten so embarrassed. And then I would blush some more. When I was in high school, I got teased because I never had good punchlines to my stories. And because I could never quite participate in class enough. A lot of times in my life, people have said things to me along the lines of, why don't you just come out of your shell? And I know that that is said with good intentions and with appreciation and with love, but a lot of times, sometimes when I hear "just come out of your shell," it doesn't land in a supportive and loving way. I hear it as saying something like, "Why are you so shy? Just stop being shy." Or, "There's something weird about you if you are so quiet, or if you need so much time alone." It was really validating, therefore, when I discovered a book which is called Quiet: The Power of Introverts in a World That Won't Stop Talking. She talks in her book about the writer is named Susan Cain, and she's a writer and a lawyer and a self-identified quiet person, and she talks about introversion and shyness and highly sensitive people, and sort of it's slightly, they're different things, but kind of she talks about them all in different ways. And she argues that those of us who are quiet in some way need to lead from our place of strength, from who we really are. Things like, often things like creativity, reflection, thinking and understanding something deeply, rather than exhaust ourselves trying to pretend like we constantly need to be around people, or that we're some kind of fast-talking, thinking on our feet types of people. She also said something besides that, which was that people who are introverted or don't like to be outgoing can often do really well in professions that are against type, that are sort of more traditionally extroverted, or require a lot of social time, if that is a profession or a vocation that is really meaningful to that person. And that resonated with me, of course, because I'm a person who needs a lot of alone time, and as I was going into ministry, I've had this fear of, like, what am I doing going into this profession where I'm constantly surrounded by people? Won't I get tired? Or maybe I'm just a little bit too awkward to be in this people-oriented vocation. And reading Cain's book and understanding about doing things, both the importance of taking care of oneself and about doing things that matter, helped clarify this for me. And I share all of this not as some kind of introvert manifesto, which you can read her book, and it is an introvert manifesto. But as a way to say, as an example of a way that, to say that most of us at some point in our lives feel weird or awkward or like it's not easy being us, right? Like it's not easy being green. Seems like you blend in with so many ordinary things. And people tend to pass you over because you're not standing out like flashy sparkles in the water or stars in the sky. And on the other hand, sometimes I know it can be not easy standing out like flashy sparkles in the sky. People have been made to people who are extroverted or have a big bubbly personality can also be made to feel weird or awkward or like it's hard to belong. I have minister friends who I talk with, and I know of a couple who are very big personality and extroverted type people who have gotten feedback that they really need to tone it down. So this sense of not feeling quite belonging, feeling a little weird, feeling like it's not easy being who we are, I think is actually a pretty common, if not universal, human experience. Many of us have at some point felt like we're just not good enough or something's wrong. Maybe like the person in our reading, maybe you grew up gay in a religiously conservative environment. Maybe society taught you that your life matters less than someone else's life because of your race or maybe because of your immigration status. Maybe you feel like your body isn't right, isn't considered beautiful. Maybe you wonder, how can I love myself? And I think there are a lot of things that contribute to this. Some religious ideas, of course. I think capitalism and consumerism as well is one of those forces. You can't sell people things unless they feel like they need them. And so there's a advertising needs to make you feel like there's something wrong that the product can fix. And it's hard to, living in the culture we live in, I think it's hard not to be affected by that. There's also this idea of working for our worth, like we have to do more in order to be worthy, in order to be good. I don't know if it's Protestant work ethic or some kind of salvation by doing the right things exactly. The idea that if you just, that there's something deeply wrong with us and we can only fix it by acting in certain ways. And I will say that this is the one that I think can creep into even our churches and activist circles. Something I notice as someone who pays attention to, to efforts for social justice, to working on congregational organizing for living out our values in the wider world. I don't know, have you ever encountered a social justice or social change effort that you felt was at least partly motivated by shaming? Like, the way to motivate people to get involved is to make them all feel like they're bad people if they don't help. And this one is tricky, right? Because I think we are definitely called to do work, called to do what we can to make things better even when it's hard, and to live our values, to live with integrity. And that's important, and I talk about that. And I'm our minister for congregational life, and that includes social justice, so I talk about that a lot. But I want to be clear that our worth as people and human beings doesn't depend on things that we do. We are enough as we are. And I think actually that when we can do social justice work out of a place of love and calling rather than out of guilt and shame, then it's much more sustainable. We are enough. We worked with this notion, this idea of enoughness last year when we talked a lot about the work of Brené Brown, who is a shame researcher. And if you haven't read, if you weren't here, you didn't read her book, The Gifts of Imperfection, or her other work, Daring Greatly, or seen her TED Talks, I recommend doing it. It's been really, really thought, something I've really been chewing on in the last couple of years. To do a quick recap, she talks about shame and vulnerability. Shame is different than guilt. Guilt is feeling like I did something wrong, I made a mistake, my behavior was wrong, and shame is feeling like I am a mistake, or I am bad, or I am wrong. And guilt can be motivating for acting ethically and understanding when you've hurt someone, and shame can become this sort of swamp she talks about that you can get stuck in. And her research shows a couple of things, which is that shame is, as far as she could tell, a universal human experience. We all struggle with it at certain times and to different degrees. And so it's something we all experience, and at the same time, we can get better at responding to shame, becoming resilient to it, and getting out of the shame swamp. And the way that we do that, her research suggests, is by cultivating authenticity and vulnerability, healthy vulnerability, where we can share something of who we really are, our mistakes, our doubts, our shame, with someone who can be trusted to hold that with empathy and without judgment. And that creates a real sense of belonging that can then help us move forward. The power of vulnerability being held by someone, by hearing someone say through their words or through their presence and their listening, "I like you just the way you are." "I like you just the way you are" is a message that a lot of those of us who grew up in the last 40 years, many of us first heard most memorably or most directly or from that noted Presbyterian minister, Fred Rogers. Did you guys know Mr. Rogers was a minister? Some people did. Yeah, he was ordained to the special ministry of children's television. And he told multiple generations of children what I think is probably the most important thing for them to hear and for adults to hear also, which is, "I like you just the way you are." It's somehow this service began as a talking about shame, and it has turned into getting a lot of wisdom from children's television. We had It's Not Easy Being Green and Mr. Rogers, and I think it's interesting that a lot of times when we think about shame and liking ourselves just the way we are, the best resources we have are things that talk to children. And at the same time, it's a message that adults need to hear too. Mr. Rogers, of course, he knew that children needed to feel like they were liked in order to grow up into healthy and emotionally competent adults. And he also knew that that can be hard. And he once said this, which I think is very wise: the toughest thing is to love somebody who has done something mean to you, especially when that somebody is yourself. Look inside yourself and find that loving part of you. Take good care of that part because it helps you love your neighbor." It turns out that Mr. Rogers knew that compassion begins with self-compassion. Loving your neighbor begins with loving yourself. And he's right. In recent years, I have been doing some practice of metta meditation, which is loving kindness meditation. I know some of you are practitioners of this. And I can tell just from my somewhat limited experience that he's right about self-compassion and the importance of it. Now, he, of course, was not a Buddhist teacher, but I think you'll hear an echo in those teachings. Sharon Salzberg is a meditation teacher who teaches about this particular kind of meditation, and she wrote this: "When we do metta practice, we begin by directing metta toward ourselves. This is the essential foundation for being able to offer genuine love to others. When we truly love ourselves, we want to take care of others because that is what is most enriching or nourishing for us." Even from my limited experience, I can tell that there's something true about this. When I am able to start with compassion or love or care for myself, I feel a little bit more tender toward people I encounter in my life, people I encounter in the world. So we're actually going to take a minute and practice beginning with self-compassion. So you can just sit quietly, participate as you feel you want to, and you can just kind of direct goodwill and loving kindness and care towards yourself. Or in your mind, silently, you can repeat some of the phrases that are traditionally taught with this practice. And some of them, some versions of them are this: may I be free from danger. May I be happy. May I be healthy. And may I be at ease. So I'll keep track. We'll do a little bit under a minute. And just be kind to yourself. May I be free from danger. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be at ease. Thank you. I like myself. I'm glad I'm me. This is the essential foundation of being able to offer genuine love to others. Genuine love to others is something that perhaps if you're like me, you've been noticing a distinct lack of in our public discourse and kind of ethos recently. And I know that it's an election year, and that's not unusual for an election year. Things can get bitter, things can get hostile, things can get very polarized. And I feel like it's unusually, the public rhetoric is unusually full of open contempt and conflict recently. And I've been doing a lot of wondering about why that might be. And there's several reasons. I think some of it has to do, honestly, with persistent racism that is in kind of the underlying underbelly of our country and has been there sort of in the DNA since it began, kind of tends to erupt under stress. Some of it, I think, is actually about political polarization is actually underlaid, is that a word? The underlying cause is income inequality. There's research that suggests that large gaps in income inequality correlate with and in fact cause political polarization, and the two of them feed into one another. You can look at the graphs of polarization and income inequality, and they're shockingly correlated. So Google that. And I think that there is an emotional and spiritual component as well. When we feel shame, we can dig through it and deal with it, or if that's too painful, sometimes we deal with it by with blame and blaming other people, trying to externalize our feelings of inadequacy and badness by shifting that onto somebody else, by scapegoating, trying to make it someone else's fault that we feel bad or that things don't feel right. Brené Brown said that blame is the discharging of discomfort and blame. And when I look around, when I listen to things, I feel like there's a lot of blaming happening in our country, in our political discourse, in our public culture. And I wonder, I have an idea that this maybe means we have a lot of shame that isn't being worked on. And so, as someone who cares deeply about social justice, about civic engagement and building healthy communities, I think that alongside working explicitly for social justice, for change, for economic equality, we also need to work on our own stuff, to be a congregation of caring people where we can learn to be more resilient through shame and take that resilience and the things we've learned out with us into the world. I think one of the roles of spiritual community is to build places where that vulnerability that we've talked about can be held in trust and in care. And vulnerability, I want to say, vulnerability can look a little bit weird. One of the pressures on us is the idea that we have to be cool and uncaring. And I think our culture can, you can tell me, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the dominant culture that I'm familiar with sort of labels earnest expressions of deep emotion as weird or corny sometimes. And so this being a place of emotion and caring and imperfection can sometimes require embracing the corniness, I think. You will know, those of you who are new, you will shortly be introduced to our closing ritual here, which is where we join hands. You are invited, as you're comfortable, to join hands as we sing a song. And the song sings about how we yearn for justice and joy and a love that we're all a part of. And sometimes we even like to sway a little bit. And Sharon and I had a conversation where we noticed that sometimes this isn't always easy for all of you. Some of you maybe feel like it's uncomfortable or like there's a learning curve sometimes when you come in to be cool with that. And I want to say both that it's okay if you don't want to do it and it feels weird, participate as is comfortable for you, just the way you are. And I think it's really great. I think it's spiritually healthy to have a place where we can be openly joyful or openly tearful and openly everything that's going on, because we do desperately, I think, want a place of more justice, more joy, and more love. I said at the beginning of the sermon that I worried about going into this profession because I was afraid I would get tired and that I need a lot of alone time and that would somehow be hard or that the social thing would be too much of a challenge. And I remember what Susan Cain says in her book about how doing work, part of what mitigates the difficulty of working against type is doing work that is deeply meaningful. And so I do this work because it's deeply meaningful to me, because I believe that the message of being worthy of love and belonging just the way we are, not depending on anything we do or who we're in relationship with or what we do, is deeply, deeply important and transformational. And that's been the case for me as I accept myself just the way I am, I'm actually more able to grow, interestingly. And so when people say, come out of your shell, I don't actually do that by just deciding to or by trying to be someone else. I do it by saying, I like myself. I'm glad I'm me. And so my hope is that this is a place where you can also do that and where we can help one another in that growth, where this is a place to embrace yourself exactly as you are, whether it's quiet or exuberant or feeling deeply like you belong here or like you're still a little bit on the edges, feeling like you're powerful, feeling like you're powerless, whether you have hippo hips or purple polka-dotted lips, just as you are. And even if you find all of this earnestness uncomfortable, I like you, just the way you are.